You feel its edges in your mind before they even reach your fingers. There's a tremor inside it. Dare you open it? Too late. You already have. Welcome to Haunted MTL's Combo Box, with contributors John Combo and J.M. Brannick.
Okay, welcome everyone to Combo Box. I am your host, J.M. Brannick, aka Box Human, along with my surgically grafted co-host, John Combo.
Hey, it's a little tight back here.
Yeah, well, you're going to have to deal with it.
All right.
Did you bring any combos this time?
No, and I have a story about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I went shopping Monday, combos, found the combo aisle at my local grocery store, found the different varieties. I mean, there are lots of, and the one I was most amped to get was they make a 7-layer dip flavored nacho, or flavored combo. I don't know how you get 7 different flavors into something that small.
You pray and you hope.
That's it. But that was what I was going to come back for before the weekend. And sure enough, Friday I go and the aisle is cleared out. So
I told you they're staples.
If I have learned anything about the apocalypse, apparently combos are right up there with toilet paper and canned soup. So. Mm-hmm.
And chicken.
Yeah, chicken. Mm-hmm. But the pork's still there. I don't get that one.
They probably just wrap the toilet paper around the chicken, around the combo, and then throw it into the oven.
Probably.
At 375 for about 20 minutes.
About 20 minutes, okay.
And then you take it out in the oven. It's delicious. Anyway, this is why you were grafted onto my body and not the other way around.
Roger that.
Yep. So as our long-running joke, I bit the bullet and ate a combo box from a fast food place today. It was called a Chalupa Lupa, I think was the name. Chalupa Lupa. And it was not from Burger King. But basically, it was like a human centipede chalupa.
Oh.
That you rip free from each other and devour. It was surprisingly spicy, which constitutes as a solid jump scare in my book.
Fair enough.
Yep. And it was just like this amalgamation of Taco Bell things, like just kind of smushed in together. So taste-wise, it was kind of like, eh. But as a horror terror thing, I would give it 4 Cthulhus.
I gotta say, comparing it to the human centipede is by far the most off-putting thing you could have.
It was exactly like that. And they were screaming all the way down.
Yikes. Is it like all the same meat, or is it like steak and ground beef and chicken?
I think it's just ground beef.
Just ground beef, okay.
I mean, you could probably mix it up. I don't know if that would like rain hellfire or anything, but if you do mix it up, you're a sick, twisted individual. But anyway, we are here to talk about a special movie to both of us on our second ever podcast.
Right.
And here are some alternate titles, so you can try to guess along at home to figure out what this really special movie is. So my first alternate title is Fingers in a Box.
Yeah.
Because okay. That's like it, fingers and a box. Okay.
Yep,
fingers in a box. 90% of the movie.
All right, so my first alternate title would be My Stepmom's Bony Boyfriend.
Yeah. It's slimy too.
Slimy, yeah.
Yeah.
Beauty.
They have the good slime going on. My second one would be Filthy Frank and His Fiendish Adventures.
Good.
It sounds like kind of like a kids cartoon comedy. It's not. What's yours?
All right. Number 2. So 4 guys walk out of the wall.
They do.
Not great, but
that's okay. I'll take it. Next is of mine is Julia, like Confessions of a Twisted Bitch. Kind of like a Tyler Perry kind of vibe.
I think the further along we get, the more we just give it away.
What? No.
So on the same token of the same character, my next title is How to Nail Three Guys and Screw Over Two More.
That's a good one. That's a good one. All right. I have two more left.
Okay. I got one more. So you go and I'll go.
Okay. I have one that's going to give it away, but one I'm going to end on as my official one.
Okay.
So this is the one that's going to give it away, but Come to Daddy is Gross. Get the fuck over yourself.
So my last one is How I Met Your Brother.
Yeah. That's a good one too. That's a good one. And my very last one, which I would go with, is Night of the Paper Hat.
Oh, the dinner. That's right.
That's the working title. Night of the Paper Hat. Okay, so if you're playing along. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay, if you're playing along, you've probably already guessed what we're talking about. We're talking about Hellraiser, aka The Hellbound Heart, which is the novella. Honestly, title-wise, I prefer The Hellbound Heart. I think that would have gone a lot better with the story and the characters and things like that than Hellraiser. But that's just me.
Yeah, I'm not. I have yet to find the background behind that. And somebody listening, I know, is probably going, Clive Barker did blah. And you know what? You please comment, because it's like the one bit of Hellraiser trivia I do not know.
Comment and yell at John.
That's right. Yeah. Come on. Just find me and just yell at me and be like,
find him on an alley. Yeah. Eat some crickets and then scream it at him.
That's right.
Be like, www dot.
If you stick it in a box of crickets and throw it at me, I will completely understand.
But so this is a movie franchise that was probably, you know, not supposed to be the franchise that it is today. Probably. Before it was the book. So to get into this podcast, I rewatched the movie to refresh myself of everything going on. So we're kind of going to dive into it. We're going to talk about the movie, and then we're going to talk about the book, and John is going to tell us about how the book and the movie are kind of different, and just some cool stuff like that, because I have not read the book. I just watched the movie. John, how did you come into this? How did this come into your world? How did the Cenobites enter your world? Did you find a box?
Honestly, it was just, it's one of those movies, Hellraiser Hellbound, Hellraiser 2, were just some of those movies that were always on the weekend. You know, you got the edited for TV versions. But I gotta say, for some reason, Hellraiser always appealed to me over like Halloween or Nightmare on Elm Street. I don't know why, but I can definitely say that my fascination with occult horror comes from Hellraiser.
Okay, fair enough. I'll give you that. Mine is actually pretty recent. Okay. It was kind of like always in the background with the others. And again, it was kind of like one of those titles that I would see the Pinhead, aka Lead Cenobite. I'm going to call him Lead Cenobite in this because that's how he's spelled.
Thank you.
So you would see, you know, his face. You would see like the puzzle box in like magazines, like you could buy it, you know, and stuff like that. So it was always kind of there, but it was always with everything else. So I was like, you know, I guess I'll get to it eventually. Well, I did get to eventually. I was an adult. It was about probably 3 years ago now. And then it was on Netflix. I'm like, hey, I'll give this a whirl. And I was just blown away. I was just blown away. I was like, I want to say it's a gem that I found.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a gem that I found. Everybody found it. But I feel like it was, like, especially in all of the other horror movies. And don't get me wrong, I love my slashers. I love my Halloweens. I really love my Friday the 13th. But this was special. It was very unique, very different. Right. And we'll get kind of into that of why it is. But so that was kind of like, so I came to really more on it as an adult than growing up with it. It was more kind of background. So
let me ask. So you coming to it as an adult, one of the iconic scenes and one scene that is still particularly praised for how well it was done for its time was Frank coming back together.
Mm-hmm.
Larry dropping his blood on the floor.
Spoilers in this episode.
What's that?
There's spoilers in this episode.
The movie's 33 years old. If
just go watch it. It's around, but there's gonna be spoilers. But yes, Frank
coming back. That whole scene of him building himself back up is iconic. So, what did you think about the effects?
They were amazing. I love practical effects. I'm mm-hmm. huge into practical effects. I prefer them over CGI. Like any day. And so when I saw that and I just saw, it was so beautiful and so beautifully done that I was just blown away. Like all the effects in it are really good. Even just the simple ones. Just like when Julia, after her first killing, she has all of the blood and she's wiping the blood off of her and she's in the mirror. And it's just a very tight shot of her face.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I mean, I know it's not an effect, but the cinematography is just like, you see into that character and just, everything was just wonderful. But yeah. Yes, that was an amazing, kind of like, it reminded me a little bit of like the transformation scene in American Werewolf.
Thank you.
In London.
Yep. Okay, yeah.
To where it's like we get to see something build itself. And mm-hmm. it was so, and it was satisfying too, because it was like you got to see parts of it, add to parts of it to create right. human. Well, kind of human.
Kind of human, but kind I mean, of
human.
You, everybody knows, like when you see, you know, like the ribs. And the bits of flesh start like readhering to the bones and the brain start to form. Everybody knows what that is.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a surprise, but to see it.
And the rats are freaking out. Yeah. Like, we don't like this.
Right.
And I was there with them. I'm like, I'm so sorry. You have to witness this. And then he screams and then it goes into the most amazing scene ever, which is the dinner party. But yes, no, as an adult, it made me very nostalgic and it made me miss those practical effects.
Yeah.
Very rarely do I get to see those nowadays. So when I do see them in movies that are made today, that are really well done, that are lovingly done, it makes me think back on things like that, that were pioneered by special effects. I think a lot of times too, people will point to the special effects and be like, oh, this is why it's bad for people, you know, to watch horror. Because it's all gross and slimy and, you know, insides of people. But in a way, it's kind of cathartic because it's like, this is a safe way to do it. These are all, like, I can look at it and be like, these are all effects. This is some art. This is art.
Yep. No, you're right.
And so that scene with the music, with the sounds, the Foley work in this is amazing. I've written that down in my notes like several times, like Foley okay. work is great. So many squishes and squelches and like the female Cenobite cat meowing sounds. Just amazing, amazing Foley work. So I didn't get a chance to write down the Foley artist's name. I apologize about that, but they did an amazing job because it was, and when he first comes, Frank first comes out and he's just like squish, squish, squish. When he walks across the floor, you're like, ooh.
Yeah.
That's human squishness. But so I hope I answered your question. I still, as an adult, there's some jump scares, but the atmosphere just blew me away.
Right.
Just blew me away. And I guess we can kind of get into this now, but what I wanted to say about this too is what I've noticed about some of the greatest horror movies that we have and that we love and that we cherish, the monsters in them are really not present very much in the first one, or there's only a taste, or they're not even really the monster. Kind of case in point with this one, the Cenobites really didn't do anything.
You're right.
At all. They just kind of stood there the entire time, which is fine. They did a great job standing there, you know. Good job.
But I will say, thinking about this series as much as I have, the reality is that for the sake of this movie, the Cenobites are not the antagonist.
No, they're not. Julia and Frank.
Yep. They are.
And honestly, it's Julia. If we want to get right down to it, it is Julia. All right, we'll jump there. Let's jump there, John. Okay? Let's go there. This actress is fantastic. She's amazing. Julia is a stone cold bitch.
Yes.
I
think that the relationship between Larry and, I'm sorry, catch me. If I say Larry in regards to Hellraiser, I'm doing good. If I say Roy, I'm wrong because Roy is the Hellbound Heart. But we'll get into that later. But it's like, it's such there's such contempt there. I mean,
For no reason. I have no idea. Like, you never get an inkling that he cheated on her or that he, you know, it's such the, it kind of reminded me of like in Liar Liar when, you know, like she's in love with that other guy. She's going to marry that other guy. Yes. And he's a nice guy. He's a nice guy. There's nothing wrong with them, you know, but you're like, oh, you're supposed to hate him. Why? Larry's great.
Right.
The whole time I'm like, Larry's great. I feel bad for him.
Right.
Because he gets fucked over.
There's no answer to it. There's no like, why didn't, if Julia was just that unhappy, leave.
Yeah, you know, I mean, divorce
him. To the point where you move back into this house that, as far as the movie is concerned, it's apparently the same house they got married in the vicinity of, moved away, and now they're moving back to this location. So, you know, this house has so many memories for Julia and not the same memories for Larry. It starts that rift, and then Frank shows up.
And even before that, like, I mean, let's talk about flashbacks. Mm-hmm. We're going to be all over the place with this podcast because there's so much to talk about. So much to talk about. And I have notes. They're scribbled like a madman's notes, like all over pages with only things that I will understand. So sorry, guys. It's going to be kind of all over the place because it's so juicy, the story.
Yeah.
I mean, but so we see it in a series of flashbacks that Julia, before she even got married, and she is not the first wife of Larry. She is the second wife. His first wife has died. We don't know of what. Car canceritis. as some people say.
There you go.
That was Kirstie's mom.
Yes.
We don't know why, but Julia is his second wife. And just before their wedding, literally her dress is on the bed. I don't know why, but her dress is on the bed. Like she's getting ready for it.
We'll get into that.
Okay.
That's, again, more that's explained and
perfect.
Heart that, yeah.
Great. Because I had questions. Because I'm like, who just is like, I'm just going to throw my wedding dress like on the bed. Just for funsies. Anyway, so we see in a series of flashbacks that Frank, brother Frank, as he says, which he sounds ADR'd throughout the whole entire thing. And he could be. He could be. Every line read sounds so, it sounds like a robot has ADR'd it. No offense to the actor. No offense to the production, but it sounds like a robot ADR'd it. So brother Frank comes back and she's immediately smitten by him. We don't know why. He's filthy Frank. He's terrible. He's an awful weirdo, and we'll get to that soon. But and he comes in and he seduces her, which is not really, it doesn't take that much because she's already all over him.
Right.
And they fuck on her bed. I assume the bed that she shares with Larry on her wedding dress. And then immediately after they fuck, he's like, it's not enough. And just like gets out of there.
Right.
Which I hope is explained too, which I think I have inklings of why he's like that. Cause he's looking for a thrill. He's looking for something. This is, again, I'm looking at the movie. I'm not looking at the story. I'm looking at the movie, and it is like, I just fucked my brother's to-be wife. That was exciting, I guess, but it's not to what I need. It's not enough feeling and pleasure, because the whole thing starts off with him and the box. So I guess we can start at the start.
Yep.
And if you are into fingers, male fingers, I should specify that, male fingers, this is the movie for you. Especially fingers and mouths.
Oh, yeah.
Fingers and mouths are bananas in this movie. They're constantly going into mouths or close-ups of fingers. So, okay, so starting off, we are in an indiscriminate foreign market of some place. You don't know where, but there are two people. They both have really dirty fingernails. It is gross. One of the dudes buys the box and immediately is in a room full of candles in a square and is shirtless and sweaty. And his nails are clean, by the way, at that point. So he washed his goddamn hands. So we figure out this is Frank. And he opens up puzzle box. Chains come out of darkness. And then we're transported. Now, I forgot that this was actually in the room of the house.
Yes.
Is that correct?
It's in that upper room, yeah.
Okay, so basically, okay, so here's my, so he went to a foreign place to buy the box, and then flies back to open the box.
Yep, you're I'm not stopping you yet. There are answers to these questions.
Okay. Does he have to be shirtless?
I don't remember.
Does he have to have a square candle? Because usually it's a candle circle. Like that.
I think that was the square, The square was like the minute representation of what I'll call the offering, which there's a bit more that it gets into in the Hellbound Heart as to what he's supposed to do.
Okay. Okay. So there is a thing.
There's a reason.
There's a conjuring thing he's supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's part of the conjuring thing. Okay. So we see these, you know, these hooks come out and they tear into his flesh. And the next thing we see, we're in this otherworldly place and there's like bloody pieces on the ground. Like the Cenobites are not clean people. They leave their body parts everywhere. There's like a mess on the floor. And putting together, they're putting together his face on a table.
Yep, they're finding the pieces and reconstructing his face.
Yeah. For funsies, I'm assuming. And that is to do something.
That is simply for effect.
Okay.
That's not even, yeah.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Because I was like, where does this fit into the puzzle of pain and pleasure? It's like, what do I really want? I want you to turn my face up and put it back together.
No, this was, that whole idea is that they literally just broke him down.
Okay.
It was like they reduced
physically,
him.
Physically broke him down. Okay, I get that. I can get on that. All right, very cool. Okay, so then after that, we see Julia and Larry come into the house. They've moved back. They haven't been in this house for a really long time. It belonged to his parents, but after they died, Frank wanted to keep it, yada, yada, family bullshit. This is what I want. I want a prequel. I want a prequel of Larry and Frank. Because how the fuck are they brothers? Like, how did they grow up? Frank is a sociopath.
Yeah, he is.
I mean, like, how did they grow up? I want to see this. Because Larry is so nice and sweet and just well-rounded and grounded. And Frank is fucking insane. He's weird. Okay, anyway. But I do want to see that. I want to like see a Christmas episode. That's not going to happen, but if I had $1 million
Christmas at the Cotton residence.
Yeah. Yep, Cotton Christmas.
The Cotton Christmas.
Here's Ma and Pa. And here comes Frank. And he's all boozed up even though he's like 9.
Right.
So they come in. Frank has been there. He's into weird shit because there's like photos of him like fucking women in masks. And there's a lot of religious iconography, statues and stuff like that. And even like Larry's like, huh, Frank's into weird shit.
Yeah.
Kirstie should check this out. She'd love it. And I'm like, what? Okay. But anyway, Kirstie arrives and she is amazing. She is one of my favorite protagonists in film. What about you?
Ashley Lawrence, I know I looked up her filmology a couple days ago just in preparation for this because I forgot how many things she's in, and unfortunately, you know, I'd hate to think that any actor or actress gets typecasted.
Mm-hmm.
Because she, as let me just assure everybody listening, she has appeared in 4 Hellraiser movies. 4.
It's a lot.
The fact that there are 4 Hellraiser movies is a lot. Not to mention that there are actually 9. I'm pretty sure.
And there's going to be a crossover, I hear, with the Fast and the Furious.
Oh, my word.
And Annabelle. And they're driving.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. The hell car. Hellcat. Yeah. Pinhead's going to have the Hellcat.
It's kind of like Death Race 2000.
Oh, Death Race.
Anyway.
But she's been in so many things, and she does great in all of them. I don't want to think of her as being typecasted for Hellraiser. She was the Hellraiser actress, but no, she has done other things, and she does great in all of them. It's
underappreciated.
Yeah.
Sorry, but she should. I mean, I love Jamie Lee Curtis, and I feel like this actress could have been something like that, because she has such a wide range.
Yes.
I mean, she can be tough and vulnerable all in the same second, and it is amazing. So I feel bad, because I do feel like she was typecasted and kind of pigeonholed into that. And unfortunately, I think especially in the 80s and 90s, there really wasn't a lot of good juicy roles for women like that, you know.
Well,
who could play that?
I'm going to touch on that on a small retrospective toward the end, because the era we're talking about was women, but we'll get to that.
Okay. All right, fair enough. Okay, so Kirstie comes in, and you know, it's a nice house and it needs cleaning, and Julia's being an inconsiderate dick to the movers, because one of them wants a beer and she's like, go fucking get it yourself. And so Larry, sweet Larry, goes and gets it and things like that. But anyway, the weird thing, I want to also mention that Kirstie and the dad character, and I'm so sorry, I don't have their names. Yeah, I'm a piece of shit. And he was in Pumpkinhead too. And I was so sad to see him in Pumpkinhead too, because he was so much better than that movie. So much better. I was like, no, Kirstie's dad, get out. Anyway, they have so much chemistry. They actually are really good together. They do feel like a dad-daughter, you know, combo. And the only weird thing is that they do kiss on the lips. I didn't like that. And she does call him daddy.
Oh, wow.
Hmm?
That's, I, you know, it didn't faze me when I saw that.
It's all that I'm like, I would not kiss my dad on the lips, but, you know, but they're close, especially after her mom's passing. They're close. You get that sense that he means the world to her, and he should. He's Larry. He's great. And Julie is just kind of a bitch. But anyway, yeah, that's when we get kind of into the flashbacks and things like that. And Frank being 100% unappealing. He's kind of like a really dirty John Stamos, I would say.
Okay.
And when he actually does like grab her to kiss her, I don't know if you noticed, but he kisses her chin.
Yeah.
Instead of her mouth. I found that weird. Anyway, but I did find it funny when she was like, what about Larry? And it's like, knife flick, forget him. But I think he's a serial killer before all this.
Yeah, we can't evaluate the kill count before the movie.
No. But yeah. But then he gets all pissy because it's never enough. And right then, it's like this great climactic moment, you know, where Julia's remembering and getting sad and stuff. And Larry is trying to move a bed upstairs, and he gets his hand cut by a nail. Yes. And then he comes in, he's like, my hand, because it's all bloody.
It's bleeding bad, yeah.
It's bleeding pretty bad, and yep. It gets all in on the floorboards, all mm-hmm. the blood. I want to talk about this too, because okay. so many movies have stolen this. Because what we see then is that the blood gets sucked into the floorboards with this beautiful Foley suck noises.
Right.
And thus begins the process of Frank coming back.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen this in so many movies where they use that too, where the blood is sucked into something. And I don't know. I've been watching movies for a little while, but you know, only like, I don't know, 6 months. But I have not seen that before Hellraiser. And maybe it has been. I mean, we've had movies for a while. But it seems like after Hellraiser, that happened a lot in movies. Sure. What are your thoughts on that?
I will say, anyone who doesn't know, this was Clive Barker's directorial debut. He had produced, he had definitely written two screenplays before. I think one was Underground and the other one was definitely Rawhead Rex. And he was so, so unhappy with their adaptations that he was like, no, if I'm doing Hellbound Heart as a movie, I'm doing it. So he led kind of the development team for all of these special effects.
Amen.
And I'm trying to think now. I can't think of anything that used that type of special effect before it. I'm not saying that he did it, but he did it iconically.
Mm-hmm.
So
that and it really resonated into the culture.
Right.
I mean, when I think of it, that's the first thing I think of. And when I see it after, I think, oh, really? Come on, guys.
Well,
come on, guys.
I guess it's just one of those things where it's like, it worked, so let's incorporate it. I mean, you know, how long did we have to suffer through other movies using the Matrix dodge after the Matrix came out? I mean, years.
Yeah. And we still will.
Yeah.
I mean, it just will. I mean, and for better or for worse, you know, there are some things that can be expounded on, but anywho, it's beautiful. Yeah. And then as you had mentioned earlier, comes this beautiful scene of Frank becoming, I mean, it's just, it's beautiful. It's like under the floorboards, you can see this heart starting to form.
Mm-hmm.
And then out from these oozing pools from the floorboards, there's these like skeletal, like appendages. And then it's this just beautiful reforming body process. And the rats are like freaking out. And they're kind of cute. But spoiler, they die. And I don't understand why he did that either. But anyway. Then he fully forms and he screams and then it goes into the dinner
Your
party.
Dinner scene.
Yeah. And I do want to talk about the dinner scene. Because it is fucking bananas. I love it.
I need to hear your interpretation of this because apparently we're not watching the same dinner scene.
I don't know. I don't know why it resonates with me. It is this whole movie, like there's pockets of wow, this is so real life, and then there are pockets of oh, this is not real life at all. And like, this is like one of the pockets where I'm just like, what is going on? So I think it's just all the people there are just acting so, so fun or weird or bizarre. But anyway, sure. There's four other people. We do not know who these people are. There's no lead in. We don't get a like, hey, our friends are coming over tonight. Really?
Right.
I gotta fucking make dinner? Yep. Make sure you get all of the candles that we have and light them strategically around the room because we apparently don't have electricity yet. And then cook for these assholes. And I understand they had to have everybody there, but I would not have cooked for my friends first coming back. No, go out to dinner. Anyway, so they have a whole bunch of, it's candlelit, there's no electricity. Kirsty is like, I'm fucking this dude at the table who we find out to be her boyfriend. He flirts with her by putting a lit cigarette inside of his mouth. And then a few seconds later, pops it back out and she looks like she is down to fuck. It's bizarre. It's just so bizarre.
It was the 80s. It was a different time.
But Larry's talking about the story of like him getting his like stitches, like
yes,
for his friends. And there's this one lady there and she is fucking eating this story up. Her name is Evelyn. I looked it up. Her name is Gay Baines, is the actress. She's phenomenal. She has the best line reads ever. There's one point where she's just like, doctors. I don't know. She does it. You got to watch it to see her do it. But you're like, who are these people? There's no lead in. They're just there. And they're all having a good time. Like, everybody's drinking, even Kirsty, and everybody's having a fun time. I don't know if it's underage drinking or not, but the dad's okay with it. So, and this is where we get the line because Julia's like pissy. So she's like, I'm going to go up to bed. And this is where we get the line of, this is the night of the paper hat.
Yeah. The guests are trying to leave. No,
yeah.
You can't leave. We're celebrating something. It's the night of the paper hat.
It's the night of the paper hat. We don't know what this means. I'm telling you right now, audience, nobody in the world knows what this means. Nobody.
Just one of those lines.
And I love it. It had to have been, I don't know, and just how he says it. I love Larry. Anyway, this is the night of the paper hat.
No, but if that's, oh man. Keep going, because you got the next line, because that's my favorite line.
Oh, I don't have the next line. You have the
next line is, oh, does it still hurt?
Oh, yeah. That's Evelyn.
Oh, only when I drink.
And then they all laugh, because they're all drinking. They're having a good time. Julia's just being a bitch. But, and that's another thing that I hate, because he gets sad, because this is when I knew Julia was a mega bitch. It's because she says goodnight to all her friends. She kisses one of the guys. She looks at Larry and just walks off. Doesn't give him kiss goodnight. Bitch.
Just walks off.
I'm like, in front of their friends too. I mean, that says something, you know? So, you know, their friends are like, uh-oh, what's up with Julia? So anyway, she goes upstairs because she's all pissy for whatever reason. And she goes upstairs, she hears something, she finds the rats eating all the leftover Frank goop. And then that's when she sees Frank. And again, this actress is phenomenal because she freaks out in a really realistic way. I feel like she's like hyperventilating because he's not looking good. I forget. Is that when she knows he's Frank yet?
He's not even like fully formed. He's
just
he's like, help me. And like, it's Frank. It's Frank. Help me.
Don't look at me.
Yeah.
I still sound like I'm ADR'd by a robot. But, oh, this, yes, she does know it's Frank, but she doesn't say whether she's going to help him or not, because he's like, right. I need help. And she's like, this is too much. I'm out of here. So anyway, it shows another scene with her. She's lying in the bed with Larry. He's talking in his sleep. So what? But it's like shown, she's like wide awake and he's like talking in his sleep. And she goes and she's like, she goes to Frank. She's like, I will help you.
Mm-hmm.
And then comes a great dream sequence. It's a really good dream sequence with Kirsty. And it's great because it's not shown as like, it's not supposed to scare you, because so many times there's so many movies now that like try to jump scare you and then, oh wait, no, it's just a dream. You know right away it's a dream sequence. There's like feathers in the air and there's like babies crying,
mm-hmm.
and a blood body, and it's like, it's just very visceral. And I just wanted to give a shout out to that. Is like, how do you feel about like dream sequences, and how do you feel about this dream sequence?
I think clearly this was supposed to lead you down the idea that like, okay, this is something different. This is not, you know, this is not what's actually going on, but you know, pay attention to this. So as far as dream sequences are concerned, when they try to deliberately trick you into believing something happened, it's like, oh, look, that person didn't die. Or it's like, eh, come on. But this propelled the story, I think.
Mm-hmm. And it set it up that something is not right and that Kirsty feels it.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't know what, but she feels it. So then after that, Julia begins her murder spree.
Yes.
And the first guy that she gets, he's British too. And that was weird that they didn't mention that, like, at all. They didn't be like, oh, you're from England? What part? You know? Right. Like, if you're from, I don't know, if I'm an American, let's say in England, and I meet another American, I'll be like, oh, where are you from, John? Oh, you're from...
Yeah, which part of England are you from? Because yeah, the world's in America.
Exactly. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But he's kind of an asshole, so we're kind of okay to see him die. But anyway, so she goes into this murder spree. And the more evil she gets, the more poofed up her hair gets.
I did not notice that. That's interesting.
Well, there's this great scene where it's like you can see that she's finally kind of tasting that evilness, because she's sitting there with her glass of brandy. And at first she looks kind of concerned. And then like at the very end, it's like a long take. And then she like just kind of smiles to herself like, yeah, I'm a bad bitch. And her hair is like way poofed up. It's good. It's great. It's just poof city. But, and then we get the guy in the store with Kirsty, who's working at a pet shop that has monkeys.
Yeah.
And snakes and chinchillas and fish and crickets. But a homeless guy comes in and he's just getting some protein. He comes in and he eats some crickets. So what? He's just getting protein.
Is he getting a snack?
Yeah. It's like a protein bar, just with crickets. Just squish. Anyway, she freaks out. But that's when we kind of get the sense of this guy who's kind of following her. And he'll come back later. So, so that's when Julia's getting, starts to say, okay, what's going on? And then Frank starts spilling the beans about the Cenobites, which Spouse says, sounds like when I say it, it sounds like Cenobites.
Yeah.
Which are delicious. But that's not what we're talking. Send no bites. So we get a weird scene later. Do you want to describe the scene where Julia, like, tries to seduce Larry?
So the boxing, what's going on is a lightning storm, mm-hmm. and Frank is getting frustrated. He's mad. He's getting to the point where his nerves are starting to fire again. And I mean, if you don't have skin, I'm sure that hurts pretty bad.
That's what that was. I just thought he was like having baby tantrums.
No, he's getting it's painful and he's getting frustrated. So he's banging on the walls and Larry goes to try and figure out what's going on. And yeah, Julia essentially distracts him by just seducing him. And
which was kind of nice. It was kind of nice. It was like, she didn't want him to die.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely, she didn't want, you know, him to fall to Frank. I guess, you know, this was one last real show of emotion for Larry. And she takes him to bed. And unfortunately, Frank walks in on them. This is one of the scenes of the movie that probably unsettles most people, where Frank actually fillets. So Larry is looking at Julia. Julia is able to see over Larry's shoulder to Frank.
Larry's like kissing on her, yeah. And humping on her.
And Frank is standing behind Larry filleting a rat, which apparently was so...
Not filleting.
Filleting.
Like cutting open.
Cutting a slice of the rat off.
Just wanted to be sure that people knew.
Which apparently was so real looking that they actually had to prove they didn't kill a rat.
Oh, for real?
Yeah.
So they did a cannibal holocaust, but yes. With rats?
Yep, with rats. They had to prove they didn't actually cut up a rat. So Julia freaks out, and Larry's like, I don't know what to do with you. I don't know what to do anymore. And cut to the next day when...
Well, Larry's like, what are you doing? Like, and I feel bad for Larry, because she's... But there was like a good 20 seconds where she's like, no, no, no. And he's still humping on her.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I was like, okay, Larry, come on. Come on. But then he kind of gets off and he's like, I don't know what you want from me. Like, do you want to fuck me? Do you want me not to? Like, I don't get you, woman.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. And then it goes to the next day.
Yep. Where, I mean, him and Christy have their lunch at Chinese food restaurant.
Yeah, and that's a really sweet scene.
It is, because he's genuinely concerned. He wants Kirstie's help.
I'm going to get you.
Kirstie's really. Help with just making sure Julia's okay. And so Kirstie does it and unfortunately walks in on Julia's last victim.
Yeah, and see, that's the beautiful part of this too. When she walks into the last victim, she actually sees him in the part of getting like his life essence sucked out of him, so he's all gooey and gross. Well, he reaches out his hand to her, and this is a really great moment and why I really like her as a character, is she reaches back. She is terrified. This guy looks not good. But she actually reaches out her hand to him, even though she's really scared. And that's like one of the most noble things that I've ever seen from a protagonist. You know, usually it's like saving their own skin, and she's actually willing to put herself on the line for somebody she doesn't even know in a situation she doesn't know what the fuck's going on. And she reaches back, and I love that. I also love her first reaction to Frank is just no.
Yeah, this can't be. What are you?
Yeah, he comes into view, and she's like, no. Just like, no, nope. I love it. And this is where he also gets really bad, like, line reads. Because it's Uncle Frank. Come to Daddy.
Yeah.
Really bad line reads. But I like that she's spunky because she's like, get the fuck off me.
Yes.
Yep. You know, she nuts him. That's how she gets the box, you know, is she nuts him. And again, I just love this protagonist because she, again, she's very vulnerable, but sweet, but cares for people and is willing to do what it takes.
Yep.
But yep. So she grabs a box and Frank's like, no. And then she's like, oh, wait, you want this? And then throws it outside. And then he's like, no, like he can't go out and just go out two steps outside to get it. I mean, he could.
No.
He could. I mean, it would hurt, I guess, but he could.
But then we wouldn't have the rest of the movie.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so then she goes and walks in a daze because that's terrifying. That's just terrifying. She gets a side eye from nuns who just are rude. And then she kind of finally passes out. And then there's immediately three people around her.
Right.
Like, right there. They're like, are you okay? Which, I have to say, like, they're nice neighbors, you know? Because it looks like a kind of sketchy part of town. And
it does.
And they're right there to help her. And she gets to the hospital, you know, with the box. So they didn't steal it or, you know, like, so, where is this, Washington? DC?
I'm not, again, you know, where it's supposed to take place and where it looks like it takes place. I mean, there's British people, there's clearly Americans. I think it's a generic city.
So every town USA is A-okay by me. Well, she wakes up in the hospital, and that's another amazing scene. Yes?
Yep.
Yep. Okay. Do you want to talk about this scene?
Well, she's been, so clearly, you know, she wakes up and she has had the box this whole time. And she starts playing with it the same.
Oh, you're skipping ahead.
Which part?
Yes. Oh my God. Okay. She wakes up. There is a nurse who I think is a robot. Who is watching literally a TV that is playing a flower opening and just opening and just opening and just opening and just opening. It is the weirdest fucking thing ever. And it's a red flower, carnation. And then she sees that Christy is awake and her first response to her is, good girl, for waking up. She says, I'm going to need to get the doctor. And the doctor comes in and he's like, you're going to need to rest. And she's like, I have to call my father. And he's like, you're going to need to rest. Which again, I don't know why they don't ask who she is or do you want your parents here or whatever. Nope. And then they lock her in the fucking room. It's so weird. As, again, flower opening channel is playing on the TV. It's so weird. Okay.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
No. And there's an IV bag in there, but it's not hooked up to her.
Right. It's on standby.
This is like when I was talking about those pockets of weirdness, this is a pocket of weirdness.
Yes.
All over. Okay. So, yeah, there's, okay. So anyway, yeah. So she's on, go ahead. She's, and she doesn't even figure it out though. She's just kind of pushing it. It kind of figures out itself.
But that's the thing about the box though, is when you, getting the box is the symbol or the objective to show that you chose it? This fate.
Okay.
And then inevitably your fingers just know what to do. You unlock the box and you hear the bells and
so it's like sex.
Just like that.
And again, you
got to the one of the most cringe scenes in this whole movie where one of the Cenobites to restrain Kirsty just sticks his fingers in her mouth.
Wait, no, we didn't get to Crybaby and the tunnel creature.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, we have so Cry.
She opens the door, opens, and she starts walking in, and she hears the baby crying.
There's like this long hallway.
Long hallway.
And you hear and this then, baby cry, and it's like, oh, the dream.
Yeah. And then the wall crawler, as it will eventually become known, comes chasing after this horrific upside down scorpion looking thing, goes running after her, chasing her, and she lunges back into the safety of the hospital room. The door closes, she thinks she's fine, and then all and the then, weird stuff.
Yep. And like at that moment you're like, oh fuck. Shit's about to go down.
The IV blows up, the TV starts scrambling, and I think eventually
it becomes a white carnation.
That's which is interesting. Yes, changes it's the flower changes altogether. and then the Cenobites show up, they restrain her.
And yeah, well, again, like you said, okay, so Chatter, as he's mm-hmm. or I forget what he's billed as I think he's billed as like chatter Cenobite or chattering Cenobite in this one.
Yep.
Anyway, yeah, he restrains her by giving her like the mandible claw, basically, mm-hmm. by shoving his fingers in her mouth. And she's like, what the fuck is happening? Yes, and then all the Cenobites come out and it's a Cenobite party. And you know, basically then lead Cenobite comes out and he's like, you opened it, we came.
The box, you opened it, we came.
Yeah. He says it like, with a dark voice, deep dark voice. And that's, he's very cool. Again, as villains go, it's very interesting because they're kind of, they are the villains and yet they are not, as they say, angels to some, demons to others.
Mm-hmm.
And again, not the antagonists, you know. And again, she tries to make a deal with them. She says, Frank Cotton, which is funny that they keep names of people.
Right.
Like, oh, Frank, we know him. He loves it when you tear open his face and then sew it back together. That guy, oh, we know him. So she says, you know, Frank Cotton escaped. And they're like, no, he didn't. And she's like, yep. Again, so it's like, how are they keeping track of people? But I think maybe that's just me overthinking things. But they're like, she's like, I can give you him if you let me go. And he says, maybe, twice.
Maybe.
Yeah. He says, maybe. We'll let you go, maybe. Which, again, is kind of sporting. It's kind of nice, you know. We'll see. But a lot of people say, like, spoiler again, they went back on the word, but they didn't. He said maybe.
Right.
So, anyway, so she goes back. They, I see, this is where I kind of got kind of confused. So she goes back. She's like pounding on the door, Dad, Dad.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Chris, Julia opens up the door. She goes sees her dad. Her dad looks fine-ish.
Right.
Right. He's got kind of like blood around his scalp. And he's acting kind of weird. But she's so panicked she doesn't even realize it. And then go ahead with the next part.
Right. So she's like, we need, like, what happened to Frank? And Larry essentially is like, oh, I had to put him down. Like, he was a mad dog. I mean, like, all this phrasing, like, clearly.
He was a mad dog, not, baby.
It's not Larry.
It's not Larry. Do you want a cookie, little girl?
Right, yeah.
That's Larry.
Yeah, that was the one weird thing Larry did the whole movie.
I love that. He was just joking around. And then Julia's like, I'm sick. And he's like, oh, honey.
Yeah.
Anyway.
He never jokes around again.
Yeah, I know. Night of the paper hat. All right.
So he tells Julia, go show Kirsty Frank's
body. Because Kirsty's like, I want to see the body.
Yep.
So
they go, they see it. Julia actually closes the door with Kirsty in the room, seeing this flayed body on the floor. And as you know, she goes to check the door. The door's locked. She turns around. There are the Cenobites waiting.
Yeah, no dong this time. Like, dong.
No, they're just there.
They're just there.
And the lead Cenobite just points to the body and says, we want the man who did this. And she still presumes, you know, that her father did it. Saying, no, you can't have him. And she escapes.
Yep, she somehow runs away. And then Julia blocks her in a weird way. And she's like, let me go. And she's like, uh-uh.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, it's weird. Then she finds out that it becomes apparent.
Right. Right. Some of the language he starts using, I think he actually says, come to daddy.
He does say, come to daddy.
And she's like, oh, okay, now I get it.
And she says, oh, God.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, my God.
And then everything just goes downhill from there.
Yeah. Yep. Julia gets stabbed. And then, goo sucked from Frank.
Yep. So Frank is actually the Julia's demise. I mean, she doesn't die right then and there. She makes it upstairs, is able to find the box, and it's actually where.
Well, we don't know that.
Yeah, we do, because that's where she finds the box.
Oh, Kirsty does.
Kirsty, yeah, comes upstairs.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And there's Julia holding the box. Now, what her intention was with the box, I'm not really
sure. Oh, no,
sure.
We don't know this in the first one.
Right. Well, we do. There's an unedited version.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. she finds the box. She gets the box back, and I'm trying not to confuse the book with the movie. Okay. Again.
Well, let's stick with the movie that is on everybody's. That doesn't happen. The only thing we see with Julia later is that she is on the bed and bad stuff happened.
Right.
Cenobite stuff happened.
Inevitably, Kirsty. Traps Frank, who is in Larry's skin.
Okay, so this is before that, and this might actually solve that because of the what you said with the cut, is because I was not sure why she hides before leading him to the Cenobites. Mm-hmm. Because she hides first. And this is when we get the Jesus jump scare, which I really like because that's unique. We don't usually get Jesus. It was like a scare thing. And that's when we find the dead dude with the maggot mouth.
Yep.
And then her coming out and sobbing on the landing, which I didn't get because she's like super loud about that.
She thought Frank had left the room and was checking another part of the house, I presume.
Well, that's not enough time. She was sobbing too loud. That was dumb on her part. But anyway, he comes out. They go into Cenobite room. She trips over her dad's corpse. Now she knows that it's her dad. And that's sad.
Yeah.
That's sad. And then, go ahead.
No, keep going.
Oh, okay. And then, like, you know, chains coming from the darkness is always a cool scene, you know? And because he's about to kill her. Well, no, that's right. Oh my God, my notes are all over the place. The Cenobites are there, and they're to take Frank, because he admits that he's Frank. And he actually takes it kind of well, to be honest. He just says, no. And then, you set me up, bitch.
Yep.
I mean, that's it. He takes it really well, which leads to my point of, this is just the experience for him, and I have something to say in a minute about that. But anyway, yeah. And they're very, very quiet demons. Like, usually if you see, like, I mean, they're not demons, but usually if you see protagonists, they're, like, usually talking up a storm or something like that. Nope, they're just kind of sitting there, just waiting. And then the chains come out, and they basically take his face and, like, smoosh it. So it's all, stretch it. So it's stretched out. So he licks his lips in a gross move and says, Jesus wept, and laughs, and then gets ripped apart.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so this is the point that I kind of want to talk about a little bit, and then we'll get to more. To me, I found that actually really disappointing. I found it really disappointing because it was actually a happy ending for Frank, in my book. Frank, throughout his character arc, was always looking for the next thrill, and especially a thrill that was caused, like, some kind of pain for somebody else, or some kind of, he was a junkie for, like, just emotions, and again, kind of like I feel like a sociopath, like, his brain just could not connect those things, so he did that, things like that to other people to almost try to feel those kind of connections. Like, Julia's obsession with him was more because he was interested in her obsession with him than her herself, because he disposed of her very quickly. He didn't, and he said even, it's nothing personal, because it isn't. It wasn't. To him, she was just another object to his desire of experience. And it should have been Kirstie's moment, not Frank's. And he got the ultimate experience, and he had control and agency over his final moments over Kirstie's. She was robbed of kind of her last girl moment, of having that control and that power, because usually in that moment, the last girl has that that control and that agency over the villain, of like, either they could say a line or not say a line or something like that, but they have, it's a turnaround, and that's what makes that death or that ending so powerful.
Right.
And that didn't happen here. So it is kind of disappointing, and it is kind of, in a way, sad, because it makes Kirstie even more of a victim. She lost, you know, her father, her stepmother, you know, and her uncle. Because we didn't know how filthy Frank was until he was, but, well, she didn't. But it robbed her of that, her agency of that, and the control of that. And I thought that was interesting. I'm not knocking it for that. I just think that's a really interesting way that they did that. He kind of got a happy ending. He got what he wanted.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, okay.
He got to see her pain and terror as he got ripped apart. So, anyway, that's my thoughts on that. And Jesus Wept was, I always thought was kind of a weird ending line.
I mean, I don't know if there was a particular reason why that was added, but that was the line.
I don't know. Maybe he's like thinking in his head, like, oh, I gotta say something. Jesus Wept.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, and I'll say that part there ends fairly true to the book.
Okay.
You know, that's how things end for him. I mean, you know, or take that for what it is. Is that the end of his torment? Is it the beginning? As far as the movies are concerned, no, it's not the end. As far as the book is concerned, yeah. So.
Mm-hmm. That's sad. And
then head from there.
Yep.
Christy has to deal with
Kirsty.
Her.
God Kirsty. Damn it.
Wow. Kirsty God has to deal with it. Her last few instances with the Cenobites, who have now decided they are going to take her.
Yep. Which is great, because lead Cenobite is like, no, don't do that.
Don't do that. Yeah. And
great actually, line read.
All of them get sent back through the box, save for the Butterball symbiote, the fat one.
Yeah.
Who just gets the house dropped in on. Yeah. So.
And Cheddar has a plastic sheet on his head, and I was wondering why.
Okay, so. It's not a plastic sheet. It's actually Julia's veil from her wedding dress.
Oh.
And that is a reference to Julia's death in the book, which is she doesn't die on the mattress the way she does in the movie.
Okay.
A Kirsty comes across her. Her head has been chopped off. She's in her wedding dress, and her veil lifts, and there's no head there. Her head is in her lap.
Oh.
So it's a nod to that scene from the book.
Well, it looks like a plastic sheet.
It does.
It looks like Chatterer was just getting into stuff, and he was like, "Oh, this looks scary. I'll put this on." Anyway.
So let's see. Yeah, Chatterer is the third to go. Butterball gets the house dropped in on
him. Yeah.
And Kirsty
and then Steve comes in.
Yes.
At the end and calls her Kirsty when they hug.
Yes.
I just want to say that.
Yeah.
I just want to say that. I had to rewind. I'm like, boy, do you really? Yeah. So.
That's one of those. It's one of those spoofs in cinematic history.
Yeah, it's an ADR line too, so it's even worse. It's like you could have done some. Anyway,
you could have edited that.
You could have definitely edited that. Anyway, I was really bummed about who the final boss was.
Really?
Yeah. It was the baby monster.
Yes.
Yeah. Who sucker punches Steve, which was kind of funny.
Which I thought was funny too. Yeah.
Yeah. But I felt it was very anticlimactic, because it's just a bunch of close-ups with Kirsty grunting.
It is, and they're like slap boxing.
Yep, they're playing keep away with the box. They are, and that's basically most of what it is. And then Kirsty grabs the box, and I loved this part. Steve tries to grab it and mansplain it to Kirsty,
and she's
like, "Fuck off, Steve."
Yeah.
I've just been doing this for the last fucking hour of my life. You come in here and tell me how to do this goddamn puzzle. No. So, yeah. So, I thought that was funny, too. I know he was trying to be helpful, but just let her do it, you know?
Yeah.
He's a good guy, but just let her do it. And then the house burned down?
Yep, yep.
Okay, to me that was unclear. Nobody called the fire department?
I mean, at that point in time, it's like, how do you explain this to anybody?
Yeah, and that's the thing that I always love at movies too, that I always try to think about when I'm watching a movie, is how fucked are they at the end? Mm-hmm. How would they have to explain that to the police? This one was actually wrapped up okay because of the house fire, but the next scene, it's just random fires. There's no house right. foundation.
Right.
There's no debris. So it just looks like they just went to a part of town that just has a bunch of fires.
There are several continuity errors.
Okay.
When you look to the next movie, if you don't think about it too hard, it's fine. if you look at it a little bit hard, it's like, if the house burned down,
I look at everything. I look at everything. So. I'm like, he just called her Christy. Fuck you. Okay, so then describe the next scene. This is the end of the movie.
So the end of the movie, they place the box in one of these bonfires. There's just random bonfires.
Random bonfire.
Random bonfires. The homeless man from the pet shop.
Guy Cricket Eater.
Cricket Eater comes walking over to the exact bonfire where they had literally just placed the box, walks into the fire, lights himself on fire.
He's all up in fire.
And all on fire and catches on fire and transforms into a dragon skeleton.
A demon gargle dragon skeleton. Sure. And then flies away.
And then flies away with the box.
Yeah. And then.
Yes.
In another marketplace in a foreign land.
Mm-hmm.
We see the same guy from the beginning that's selling the box.
Yep.
Selling the box.
To somebody else. Some other poor soul who doesn't know what he's getting into.
Yeah, so he has got a cool deal. Either he is the bone dragon, or he's got a cool deal with the bone dragon.
I mean, he's making a lot of money.
Shit tons of money. I am in the wrong business.
If the stack of hundreds that Frank gave to, I mean, and we're talking about 1980s hundreds, not 2020s hundreds.
Yeah. I mean, it was a lot of money. And how do you even advertise that? There's no internet. You have to put it like in a magazine or something. Like, are you looking for pain and pleasure? Are you looking for angels or demons? Come to indiscriminate place in a foreign land.
There you go.
And meet with a guy. I don't know. Anyway, and that's how the movie ends.
That is, yep.
And beautiful movie. Yay.
You know what? It still holds up, I think.
It does. Oh, no, 100%.
You know, for everything that it is.
I riff it because I love it.
Yeah.
I do. I pick things apart anyway. So, but, I mean, it's a beautiful movie. I love the characters. I don't love the characters. I love Larry and Kirsty.
Mm-hmm.
Steve's okay, I guess. I still don't understand why that's so hot of putting your cigarette in your mouth and then taking it back out. 80s were a different time, you know?
Really cool tricks.
I guess Kirsty's just into that.
There you go.
But if you're into, like, fingers in the mouth, this is a good movie.
There you go.
All right, so we are going to take a quick break, and then we are going to come back and talk about the book.
There you go. We got it.
Lucky beer, premium beer, Lucky premium beer, go Lively, get lucky, swing to exciting beer flavor.
Finest ingredients, aged for flavor. That's Lucky Lager. flavor that's entertaining, enthusiastic, a very exciting beer.
Lucky Beer, premium beer, Lucky premium beer.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor of the past. It was really great. Okay, so now we're going to talk about the book or the novella, The Hellbound Heart, which I have not read, but John has read and has written about on Haunted MTL, and I suggest you go and check that out.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's the groundwork for what has become a multi-film, multi-comic series franchise. The Hellbound Heart spawned an anthology called Hellbound Hearts, which is awesome as well. It actually goes a little bit into the background of each of the other Cenobites. They do a story on Chatterer, how Chatterer came to be, and how the female Cenobite came to be.
Yeah, because Chatterer is like a little kid, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Yeah. He was a little kid and who could not speak. And then, so it's kind of like the twist, like, so he couldn't speak. So when he was damned, he was blinded, and then he doesn't stop speaking. Like, that's kind of the quip about it.
How did he get the box? I know this is like,
I can't remember.
But did he fly out too and indiscriminately?
No, I'd have to go back and read that one specifically. I remember that he was a kid and he saw something he wasn't supposed to. That's the main gist of history. But the Hellbound Heart.
Yeah.
There are not a whole lot of differences. What the major difference is that Kirsty is not. Well, first off, it's not Larry; it's Roy.
That's a weird change.
It is a weird change. I did not see the reason for it, but be that as it may,
and
Kirsty is not Roy's daughter. She is his co-worker.
What?
And yes, she is his co-worker and is just seen as very
plucky.
Not even cocky. She's very withdrawn. She's very what she does.
So she's like the opposite of what she is in the movie.
Yes, her involvement is solely because of her. I'm going to say friendship. I believe there's more undertones to it than that, but her friendship with Roy.
Oh. Maybe that's why they kissed on the lips.
In
the movie. A nod.
As a nod. You know, I mean, there again, you know, you think of Chatterer in the Veil is kind of a nod to, you know, Julia being dead in the book. And everything, I'm sure, wraps around. But Kirsty does show up on moving day. Julia is just as unappreciative of her being there in the book as she is in the movie. Julia feels that there is this relationship that Kirsty feels that there's this relationship. But there really isn't, and Julia feels like she's just being nosy.
So Frank, Julia, co-workers.
Yep.
I mean, not Frank, Roy.
Roy.
And Kirsty, co-workers, friends, Julia's nosy bitch still. Yep. Is her relationship the same with Frank?
Yes.
Does she care?
Well, going to the wedding dress when Frank and Julia meet, the whole deal is Julia is actually modeling the wedding dress for Frank. That's why the wedding dress is involved. Now, Frank, the pageantry as far as Frank getting, you know, the candles and everything for the beginning scene. Well, the first chapter of the book is all about Frank setting up for this meeting. And it's not simply a matter of opening the box and the hooks going into them, but there are these processes. And
oh my God. So yes. It's kind of like,
there is a walkthrough for how you meet the Cenobites for the first time.
Oh my God.
Yes.
It's like, that's too much.
And there are these very,
I don't want to meet them anymore.
there are these very graphic depictions of what needs to happen. And actually Frank's first encounter with the Cenobites is this, what I'll call sensory overload. They're like, oh, you think you understand the extremes of your nerves, and they just demonstrate these extreme, these massive extremes of hearing. Frank has to cover his ears because he can hear everything. He has to cover his nose because he can smell everything. And it's just this absolute sensory overload. And then it all disappears, and there's a fluctuation of the Cenobites. The Cenobites don't play as big a role in the book as they do in the movie, visually. All this sensory overload stops. All of a sudden, Frank thinks, oh, it's over. And this one last Cenobite is standing there waiting for him and goes, oh, no, we've just begun.
Is that lead Cenobite?
It is and it isn't. Like, again, so Pinhead is not, or lead Cenobite is not really lead Cenobite. Lead Cenobite, the way the characters are described as far as Cenobites are concerned, the character who would become Pinhead actually has a very feminine voice. Mm-hmm. And is much more dolled up. Almost the, like, they're looked at as sexless creatures.
You know, honestly, I can't, you can kind of get that even from the movie. As I pointed out in my gender article that I did for my favorite monster, the Cenobites are very genderless.
Yes.
Very sexless. They're very, and even even visually, Pinhead himself is, yes, he's got the deep dark voice, but he is very sleek. He's very lithe. He's feminine in ways, you know. And so that's interesting too, that did translate some into the movie.
When you compare, you see it. You can see how they were trying to go for that. One of the graphic limitations from the book to the movie was actually that his tongue is pinned as well. And clearly nobody can talk with a mouthful of pins. So
That's interesting though. Kind of change too of the typical, but as we said, they're in this setting, they're not really the antagonist,
right?
But it's interesting that, because they are obviously, they are the point of horror in this, that it's different from usual points of horror,
right?
So when Frank comes back, is it kind of the same in the book?
Yes. In fact, it's a more drawn out process, only because they go into Frank being even less stable. He's not even to the point where he's at crawling across the floor. He's just literally like a part of the wall.
Oh.
Yes. So there is a much greater buildup toward making him or remaking him.
And is there, and I know in the other movies, and we can get to that on another day, but was there a reason why Frank was not turned into a Cenobite?
Because this is not specifically explored in the book, but as far as the continuation of the franchise, that level of change is reserved for very special souls. Not everybody is honored with becoming a Cenobite. We see throughout the series, save the third one, because there's a reason for that. But the other movies, if a Cenobite is created, it's because those characters met special traits.
Okay. So what special trait did CD Head make? No, I'm just kidding.
See, that's what I'm saying. Like the third one, Pinhead even specifically says, he's like, you know, they're not as good as my other companions, but they'll do for now.
This is my D squad, guys.
They definitely are. I mean, the guy has CDs in his head.
This is my D squad.
Right.
Sorry. You killed off my A squad, so what am I gonna do?
And this guy got a camera shoved in his head. You know, I'm working
trying to appeal to the new demographics. Kids like CDs, right?
Right. We'll get
it'd be more like kids like CDs, right? Anyway. No, don't do that. Anyway.
But that's it for the major changes. I will
Okay. And then you said in the end, Julia has the box as well.
Yes, she, that's more for the movies. Kirstie managed to get her hands on the box pretty much the entire time, but the Cenobites don't come after her the same way they did in this.
Okay.
It's kind of like, it's on the other side of that maybe, where it's like, gotcha, you know, we got Frank, cool.
Okay.
Because that is a much more drawn out process.
Man, this sounds just like a lot of processes.
It is. They do. It's a much more in-depth job, because even at the end, Kirstie is not completely turned off by the process of how these creatures work. The box is taken.
Is it taken by the?
It's not taken by the dragon, but it is taken by a character, and Kirstie is left just kind of like, you know what, if the box finds its way back to me, because she's looking, this is where, like, ooh, was there a deeper relationship with Roy? She's like, well, where's Roy now? And if that box comes back to me, maybe I'll find Roy again, type of deal.
He dead.
So, what's that?
He dead.
He dead. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's dead.
He's in heaven now. Because he's adorable. He would be the one to go to.
Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, that's the major differences. I would definitely say it's not long. If you guys are out there listening, it's a novella. I mean, you Clive Barker built an entire franchise off of sub 200 pages, maybe just about 200 page novella. And I mean, it's definitely worth your time if you enjoy the Hellraiser franchise.
Very cool. Do you, okay. So since you have watched and you have read, what do you think he is better at? What do you think his strength is in? Is it in like the actual visual, like, you know, with the movie, or is it with the writing?
I think I would take Clive Barker's writing over his movie work any day.
Really?
I would, and just from the span of his work that I've read, because he's a master of the short story, and he is a master of the epic novel. And I think that Hellraiser was definitely a massive achievement as far as visual effects are concerned, but I can't think of any of his other movies that I can say, you know what, yeah, that was before its time as far as visual effects are concerned.
Sounds good. Well, I enjoyed the movie. I might one day read the novella, but I enjoy the movie. So, you know, I'm happy. Anyway, that was it for this podcast, this episode. Be sure to follow us on whatever. He's on Twitch.
Yep, I'm on Twitch, John Combo, John underscore Combo on Twitch.
I'm there, but I don't do anything. So you can actually follow me probably on Twitter, Brannick, BRANNYKJ. Or just, you know, just go to our Haunted NTL, honestly. We're there. That's all I gotta say. I bid you all adieu. Do you have anything else?
No. Can you just turn around so I can see them? Still grafted to you.
Okay. No.
All right. No. Well, I'm waving backwards. Have a great week, everybody, and hope everyone's staying safe and healthy.
Yep. Ditto.